This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime. If you'd like a copy of the specially printed QSL card and a six-page information sheet by return of post, please send 50 pence in British stamps or three international reply coupons to Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6-7BG.
Digital Amplitude Modulation for Medium Wave Broadcast Transmitters by Nicholas Richards from Harris Corporation in International Broadcast Engineer. Digital Amplitude Modulation is a new modulation technique for medium wave broadcast transmitters. Developed by Harris Corporation Broadcast Division, digital amplitude modulation was introduced in March 1987 with the DX10 10 kilowatt digital solid-state AM transmitter. The digital amplitude modulation system uses a high-speed 12-bit analog-to-digital converter, a digital modulation encoder, and a digital-to-analog power converter. Input audio is converted to a 12-bit digital format by the A-to-D converter and then encoded into a format compatible with the digital-to-analog power converter. The latter reconverts the digital information back to an analog format to form an amplitude-modulated carrier with a quantized envelope. Use of this technique results in an AM transmitter with unsurpassed audio performance, efficiency, and reliability. The digital modulation process takes place in four steps. First, the modulating audio signal is processed by the audio processor, which provides an output signal that determines both the carrier power level and the modulation level of the transmitter. Second, the audio signal is converted into a digital data stream, a series of 12-bit digital words, in a high-speed A to D converter, sampling the audio at the carrier or submultiple of the RF carrier frequency. Third, the digital data from the A to D converter is encoded by the modulation encoder to provide digital control signals required by 42 of the 48 RF power amplifier modules. Fourth, the digital output of the modulation encoder is used to switch individual RF power amplifiers on and off. Amplitude modulation is produced by switching on only the number of RF power amplifiers needed to provide the transmitter RF power required at any instant. An amplitude-modulated signal has a constantly changing RF level. In the DX10 transmitter, the RF level at the transmitter output is changed by switching on either a larger or smaller number of RF power amplifiers. These amplifiers are then combined to produce the total output. RF drive to the power amplifiers is provided by a ferrite power splitter that provides equal amplitude, equal phase drive to each of the amplifiers. The RF power amplifier section comprises a total of 48 RF amplifier stages. Since 48 equal steps are not enough to reproduce the required modulation envelope accurately, binary weighted steps are used to obtain the required resolution. The 42 amplifiers controlled by the modulation encoder are called big steps, and each contributes an equal voltage to the combined output. The binary steps, bits 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, are controlled directly by the A to D converter and contribute a half, a quarter, an eighth, a sixteenth, a 32nd, and 1/64th of the voltage of the big steps, respectively. The RF amplifiers are essentially constant voltage sources whose outputs are combined in a multi-turn primary, single-turn secondary ferrite combiner. The outputs are combined to form an AM carrier with a quantized envelope. The quantized AM waveform is then filtered by a bandpass network to remove the unwanted spectral components. The power output from each amplifier stage is not constant, but depends on the total number of amplifiers or steps that are turned on at any given time. The maximum power output for a given number of RF amplifiers is limited by the current rating of the RF transistors. The audio input signal is terminated by a balanced 600 ohm input network on the audio processor assembly. A low-pass Bessel filter provides attenuation for frequencies above the required audio frequency range. The resistor network and Bessel filter provide the 600 ohm input impedance. The output of the Bessel filter feeds the input of a balanced input, unbalanced output amplifier with adjustable gain. The gain adjustment compensates for nominal audio input levels ranging from plus 10 to minus 10 dBm. The unbalanced audio signal then feeds a buffer amplifier, which is followed by a summing and inverter circuit. The summing circuit is a differential amplifier with the audio signal as one input and a negative DC voltage as the other input. The negative DC voltage determines the unmodulated carrier output level and is adjusted with the maximum power adjust potentiometer. The maximum power adjust control is used to establish the maximum possible transmitter's unmodulated carrier output level. The inverted audio then feeds the input of an integrated circuit analog multiplier that is connected to operate as a divider. The divider circuit is used to maintain constant transmitter power output with varying supply voltages. The inverted audio signal is one input to the divider. A sample of the high voltage power supply plus 230 volts DC output is the other input. If the plus 230 volt supply changes, which would cause the RF power output to change, the divider changes the audio plus DC signal level in the proper direction to compensate for the supply voltage variation. The output of the divider feeds the input of a digitally controlled attenuator. The digitally controlled attenuator has a three-digit binary coded decimal BCD control input that receives data from the transmitter power level control circuits. When the digitally controlled attenuator is set to minimum attenuation, the maximum power adjust control determines the transmitter output power. A buffer stage follows the digitally controlled attenuator with output to another differential amplifier summing circuit. The audio plus DC signal is once again inverted and a dither signal added. The dither signal is used to reduce noise which could result from the analog-to-digital process. The dither signal is a low-level HF triangle wave. The dither signal also has a big step synchronizing input from the A to D converter board. The output from the analog input board is an audio signal with a DC component and a small dither signal component. The DC component determines the unmodulated power output and the audio component determines the modulation level. A DC plus audio signal from the analog input board also goes to the DC regulator, where it produces the B minus output of the regulator. The modulated B minus can vary from zero to a few volts negative and is effectively a dynamic bias voltage for the RF power transistors, which provides for improved switching under high current conditions.
Thank you.
Solid state medium wave transmitter. When the record's quite finished, the A to D converter section takes an analog signal with a DC component to control carrier power level and converts it to a digital signal comprising a 12-bit binary word. The A to D converter section also contains circuitry to provide 1. Logic control signals derived from an RF sample for the A to D conversion process, 2. Synchronization of the 12-bit digital word with the RF carrier signal at the power amplifiers, so that power amplifier stages switch on and off at the proper times, 3. A conversion error logic signal to the status indicators, 4. Big step sync to ensure that unwanted steps or glitches in the modulated output do not occur, and 5. A 12-bit D2A converter which provides an audio signal to the envelope error detector circuit in the controller. The A to D board has an analog input stage which inverts the audio DC signal and also adds a small big step sync component. The added big step sync component ensures that when a big step occurs in the modulated output and a big step amplifier switches on or off, it does not change state again and cause a transient or glitch in the RF output. The A to D conversion process takes place in two steps. The analog input signal, audio plus DC, is sampled and stored by a track and hold circuit. The stored signal is then fed to the input of the A to D converter. The A to D converter requires less than 1 microsecond to complete the conversion process. The function of the track and hold is to ensure that the signal input to the A to D converter remains constant while the conversion process is taking place. The two steps of the A to D conversion process must occur in a certain time sequence. First, the analog input signal is sampled and stored in the track and hold IC. After the sample has been stored, a start convert signal is fed to the A to D converter. When the conversion process is complete, the A to D converter IC provides an end of conversion logic signal. Two logic signals external to the A to D integrated circuit are therefore required to control the total analog to digital conversion process. The first is a hold not sample signal, and the second is a start conversion signal to the A to D converter IC. Sample sync circuits take an RF input sample from the power amplifier RF drive splitter, divide it by 1, 2 or 3 depending on the transmitter operating frequency, and generate the hold not sample and start conversion logic signals. The sample sync circuits also determine how often the A to D conversion takes place. The sampling process that takes place in the A to D converter generates a digital audio spectrum as baseband and replicates this spectrum at multiples of the sampling frequency. The sample rate determined by the output of the divider in the sample sync circuit will vary between 400 and 820 kHz depending on transmitter operating frequency. These products are easily filtered due to the high attenuation of the bandpass filter at these frequencies. The end of conversion logic signal from the A to D converter provides data strobe signals to latches on the A to D and modulation encoder boards. Each time another analog to digital conversion is performed, the output of the converter is strobed or latched until the next conversion. If the A to D conversion process does not take place because of some fault, conversion error circuits provide a data clear logic signal to clear the latches so that their outputs can go to zero and all the power amplifier stages will be turned off. Big step sync circuitry ensures that glitches do not occur in the transmitter's modulated output. The big step sync circuitry provides two signals, one to synchronize the dither oscillator on the analog processor board, and one which is added to the audio plus DC analog signal at the input stage on the A to D board. A 12-bit D2A converter located on the AD board provides a reconstructed audio signal which is compared with the demodulated transmitter RF output in the envelope detector circuit in the DX10 controller. If the two signals do not match, as in the event of a big step missing, a red LED on the control panel is turned on. The modulation encoder section accepts the 12-bit digital audio information and encodes it into on-off signals for the RF power amplifier stages. In the modulation encoding process, the 12-bit digital input signal from the A to D converter is first latched. For the 6 least significant bits, bits 7 to 12, the outputs of the data latches provide logic signals, PA on-off control signals, through latches, or OR gates, and drivers to the 6 binary RF amplifiers. For the 6 most significant bits, the data latch outputs address ROMs. For each binary address or location with the ROM, a predetermined sequence of logic high and low signals will appear at the output pins of the ROM. These ROM outputs are also stored in data latches. The data latch outputs go through jumpers to logic inverting buffers and become the on-off control signals for the 42 big step RF amplifiers. Jumpers permit patching. If a power amplifier stage fails, to substitute another amplifier that is only turned on during modulation peaks. Power amplifiers can be patched while the transmitter is operating. Digital amplitude modulation for medium wave broadcast transmitters. The digital information generated by the A to D converter is used to switch units of RF voltage on or off by switching RF amplifiers on and off. The RF power amplifier may be thought of as a D to A converter, where the analog output signal is a high power AM RF signal. The combined action of the output combiner and power amplifiers produces equal RF voltage steps, not equal RF power steps, at the combiner output. The power output of each RF amplifier stage in the PA section depends on the total number of stages switched on. If a small number of stages are switched on, each stage contributes a small power output. If a large number of stages are switched on, each stage contributes a large power output to the total. Switching on twice as many RF amplifier stages will produce twice the voltage output and four times the power output. Each power amplifier stage is a Class D switching amplifier with four power MOSFETs in a bridge configuration. RF drive to each power MOSFET in the amplifier is provided by separate secondary windings on two transformers. Back-to-back Zener diodes provide protection for the MOSFET inputs from transients and excessive drive. Each power MOSFET in the bridge acts like a switch and is either on or off at any time. Two of the transistors, Q1 and Q4, are driven 180 degrees out of phase, with the other two transistors, Q2 and Q3. The amplifier output is coupled to the output combiner via a transformer. During one half of the RF cycle, transistor Q1 and Q4 are driven into saturation, while Q2 and Q3 are cut off. During the other half of the RF cycle, transistors Q2 and Q3 are driven into saturation, while Q1 and Q4 are cut off. This produces a square wave peak-to-peak voltage of twice the bridge DC supply voltage across the output transformer primary winding. When the control signal is in the logic zero state, the amplifier is turned off by the modulation control circuit and is incapable of delivering any power. The primary circuit of the transformer is, however, essentially complete. The drive signal for the top two devices is still present. Current is allowed to flow through the active transistor, the transformer winding, and the reverse diode of the other top transistor. This action prevents the combiner from being open-circuited when the amplifier is turned off. The modulation control is the circuit that turns the RF amplifiers on and off, depending on the signal input from the modulation encoder. The modulation section of the RF amplifier turns the amplifier off by removing RF drive to the bottom two transistors, Q2 and Q4. When the input to the modulation section is approximately 1 volt or more positive, the modulation control circuit shorts the RF drive signal to RF amplifier transistors Q2 and Q4 to ground through two diodes. RF transistors Q2 and Q4 do not conduct, and therefore no current can flow through the combiner transformer primary winding. If the input voltage to the modulation section is negative, the short is removed, allowing RF drive to flow to the gates of PA transistors Q2 and Q4. Beyond typical efficiencies of 86% at 10 kilowatts and exceptional audio performance resulting from digital amplitude modulation, the Harris DX10 incorporates other important technical features which simplify tuning, maintenance, and monitoring. Harris's standard T network enables convenient output tuning, with capability for matching loads other than 50 plus J0. Loads over a range of R equals 38 to 70 ohms and X equals minus J23 to plus J18 minimum can be accommodated, and specific frequencies may accommodate greater ranges if necessary. Maintenance is simplified with 48 plug-in and interchangeable RF amplifiers. The remote control panel on the Harris DX10 is easily accessible. Additionally, the DX10 makes complete status information readily available, with ColorStat, a standard front panel signal flow diagram which uses 28 separate LEDs to monitor key operational stages continuously. Should a problem occur, a normally green LED will turn red to pinpoint the exact location. That was Nicholas Richards' description of the new Harris 10 kilowatt solid-state digital medium-wave broadcast transmitters. And now, Eddie Caffrey with a million-selling single.
The Righteous Brothers. You've lost that loving feeling. Released in the USA on the Fillers recording label in 1964... had also in Britain on the London American label in 1964, B-side, There's a Woman. This disc was number one in both the USA with 16 weeks in the bestsellers and in Britain with 10 weeks in the bestsellers for 2 weeks simultaneously in February 1965. It was released in the USA in late 1964 and was written by Phil Spector of Phyllis Records and the husband and wife team of Barry Mann and Cynthia Wheel. The disc was released on the London label in Britain, and the combined sales from both countries took it well over the million by early 1965. The Righteous Brothers were not brothers at all. The duo consisted of Bill Medley, born September 9th, 1940, in Los Angeles, and Bobby Hatfield, born April 10th, 1940, at Beaver Dam, Wisconsin. Bill, who also played the piano and bass guitar, is a fine songwriter. Before they teamed up in 1963, they both had followings as solo performers in Southern California. Their first hit was Little Latin Loopy Lou, written by Bill Medley. Their singing was outstanding in that their style on first hearing gives one the impression they are coloured artists instead of white. Their name is derived from the Sunday go-to-meetin' phrase, man, that was really Righteous Brothers. You've Lost That Loving Feeling was also re-released in the UK in 1969, where it reached number 10. Also re-released in 1977, where it reached the top 50. And recently, in 1988, it also made the lower regions of the top 75. The recent success for You've Lost That Loving Feeling is due to its appearance in the popular movie Top Gun.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like grief in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it.
You've lost that loving feeling, now it's gone.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
With Trevor Brooke.
And Maggie Stevenson. A piece from The Guardian, Legal Loophole Sets Arms Hacker Free. Scotland Yard's Serious Crime Squad is investigating the penetration of sensitive defence and commercial information networks in Britain and America by computer hacking, following the arrest of a 23-year-old unemployed man at Surrey University. It's believed that more than 200 commercial and military organisations have been hacked into. American and European authorities were alerted after the arrest earlier this month. The man has not been charged because hacking is not a crime in Britain. Police believe he may have been working with other computer enthusiasts. Last year, a group of West German hackers, members of the Chaos Computer Club of Hamburg, broke into National Aeronautics and Space Administration computer in the US. The hackers then said they had publicised their exploits to warn about security loopholes in the computer system and because much of the NASA research involved weapons systems. Documents recovered by the Serious Crime Squad at the man's flat in Leatherhead, Surrey, showed printout information from NASA and the American Nuclear Defense Agency. They reveal he had been engaged in hacking into military and commercial computer systems for several years. The man, who is not a student, had gained access to a computer terminal at Surrey University, where he used the joint academic network to get into other systems, including those in the States. He was caught when Scotland Yard laid a trap, which tracked him through the 900 computer terminals at Surrey University. NASA may have informed the British authorities after it became aware of a hacker in its systems. A Scotland Yard statement said the man had been arrested in October on suspicion of burglary. He was questioned by Detective Superintendent Graham Seabee and Detective Inspector Larry Henson of the Serious Crime Squad after a 5-week investigation. Later in October, he was further questioned about an allegation of attempted blackmail concerning a computer company, but there was insufficient evidence, so the matter was not pursued. He was officially cautioned for burglary at Surrey University and released without charge. The man had approached a computer company and offered to show them weaknesses in their systems in exchange for cash. He later said he would tell the company without payment. Mr. Robert Schifrin, a computer magazine editor who was cleared of forgery in a hacking test case earlier this year, said he had suspected that his telephone was being tapped in recent weeks. I and my co-defendant were obviously suspects, but we didn't know anything about it, he said. There's no law against hacking in this country unless they wanted to do him for intelligence purposes under the Official Secrets Act. The way hacking normally works is that an individual works on his own until he finds part of the information he wants. Then he may contact other people. There could have been a few people working on it. After the test case that cleared Mr. Schifrin and his co-defendant, Mr. Stephen Gold, a freelance journalist, the Law Commission began a review on whether computer hacking should be made a criminal offence in Britain. The Commission, which advises the government on law, has asked for views from the public. Hacking is a crime in the USA, Canada, Sweden and France.
Telecom groups in Europe plan a new data link, by Hugo Dixon in the Financial Times from Brussels. 22 of Europe's largest telephone operators are to set up a joint venture to provide businesses with a simple and efficient means of sending data across the continent. The initiative will mean that businesses wishing to link offices across Europe will be able to get all the services they need from one point. It is seen as an important element in the linking the continent's telephone networks in preparation for the single European market. At present, companies have to deal with a separate telephone company in each country where they have an office. And because the different countries' networks do not link together perfectly, there is a high failure rate, estimated at 30%. These frustrations have led to the growth of one-stop shopping data services offered by private companies such as International Business Machines, EDS, the General Motors subsidiary, and Geisco, the communications subsidiary of General Electric of the US. To try to win back this business, the 22 telephone operators, including the West German Bundespost, France Telecom and British Telecom, last month signed a memorandum of understanding to establish the new company, Managed Data Network Services, will start operations early next year.
Reading machine gives hope to the blind. Blind people need not be totally reliant on others to read to them. Now a portable reading machine has been launched by the United States firm Kurzweil. The personal reader can read almost any typeface, loose or bound, in a variety of voices, at speeds of between 120 and 350 words a minute. The intonation varies, giving natural speech inflection. The machine does this by reading a couple of lines ahead, recognising punctuation, such as question marks, and raising its voice accordingly. The reader is not the complete answer for every unsighted person. At nearly £12,000, it will be beyond the reach of most. And claims of portability are somewhat dubious, as the two parts of the machine weigh a total of £50 and only runs off mains. But compared with the previous model, which was the size of a washing machine and completely unwieldy, the new Kurzweil is a major advancement. Because the machine recognises individual letters rather than words, it does require good quality print for clear communication. At the core of the system is a lightweight unit containing Kurzweil's intelligent character recognition software, which reads typeset or typewritten material.
Takes a taxi into town. Yellow schools of taxi fishes, Jonah and a ticking quail, caught up at the lights in the fishnet windows of Bloomingdale's. Watching those high fashion girls, skinny black models with raving curls, and beauty parlor blondes with credit card eyes, looking for the chic and the fancy to buy. He opens up his suitcase in the Continental Suite, and people stories down look like colored currents in the street. A helicopter lands on the Pan Am roof like a dragonfly on a tomb, and businessmen in button-downs press into conference rooms. Battalions of paper-minded males, talking commodities and sales while at home, their paper wives and their paper kids paper the walls to keep their gut reactions hid. For the kitchen, climbing ivy for the bed, she is lost in house and gardens. He's caught up in chief of staff. He drifts off into the memory of the way she looked in school, with her body public swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
This is Radio Fax, 6205 daytime, 1611 nighttime.
And now, the other bill which has recently been published by the Irish government from Dublin, the Radio and Television Act 1988, Act number 20 of this year, an act to provide for the establishment of an independent radio and television commission, having the function of entering into contracts for the provision of sound broadcasting services and a television programme service additional to services provided by Radio Telefish Éireann, to amend the Wireless Telegraphy Act 1926, and to provide for other matters connected with the matters aforesaid. So, straight to part two of the Act, which establishes the Independent Radio and Television Commission in section 3, subsection 1.
There shall stand established on such day as the Minister by order appoints a body to be known as the Independent Radio and Television Commission.
Subsection 2.
The Commission shall be a body corporate with perpetual succession and power to sue and be sued in its corporate name and to acquire, hold and dispose of land.
Subsection 3.
The provisions of the schedule to this Act shall apply to the Commission.
Section 4. Functions of the Commission. Subsection 1.
It shall be the function of the Commission to arrange, in accordance with the provisions of this Act, for the provision of sound broadcasting services, including a national sound broadcasting service, and one television programme service, additional to any broadcasting services provided by RTE pursuant to the Broadcasting Authority Acts 1960 to 1979.
Subsection 2A.
The Commission shall enter into contracts in this Act referred to as sound broadcasting contracts with persons in this Act referred to as sound broadcasting contractors, under which the sound broadcasting contractors have, subject to the provisions of this Act, the right and duty to establish, maintain and operate sound broadcasting transmitters serving the areas specified in the sound broadcasting contract, and to provide, as the sound broadcasting contract may specify, a sound broadcasting service.
B.
The Commission shall also enter into a contract, in this Act referred to as a television programme service contract, with a person or persons, in this Act referred to as a television programme service contractor, who shall have the right and duty to provide a television programme service.
Subsection 3.
The Commission shall not authorise a sound broadcasting contractor to operate a sound broadcasting transmitter and provide a sound broadcasting service pursuant to a sound broadcasting contract unless and until the Minister has issued, pursuant to this subsection, to the Commission, a licence in respect of the sound broadcasting transmitter to which the contract relates.
Subsection 4.
Any licence issued under subsection 3 shall be valid only for such period of time as a sound broadcasting contract between the Commission and a sound broadcasting contractor is extant.
Subsection 5.
Every sound broadcasting contract shall contain a condition requiring the sound broadcasting contractor concerned to establish, maintain and operate the sound broadcasting transmitter concerned in accordance with such terms and conditions as the Minister sees fit to attach to the licence referred to in subsection 3, including any variations made thereto in accordance with the provisions of section 7 of this Act. And so long as the terms and conditions are complied with, the contract shall have the effect of conveying the benefits of the licence to the sound broadcasting contractor, and any such transmitter so established, maintained and operated shall be deemed to be licensed for the purposes of Section 3 of the Wireless Telegraphy Act 1926.
Subsection 6.
Every licence issued by the Minister to the Commission under subsection 3 shall be open to inspection by members of the public at the Commission's registered offices.
Subsection 7.
It shall be the duty of the Commission to ensure that every sound broadcasting contractor and the television programme service contractor complies with the provision of this Act.
Subsection 8.
The Commission shall have all such powers as are necessary for or incidental to the performance of its functions under this Act, including, in particular, the power to require sound broadcasting contractors and the television programme service contractor to enter into financial bonds with the Commission and to direct a contractor to record any or all of the programmes broadcast by him in the case of a sound broadcasting contract or provided by him in the case of a television programme service contract, and to retain such recordings for a period of 30 days after the recording is made, and to submit the recordings to the Commission if the Commission so requires.
Subsection 9.
The making of a recording by a contractor pursuant to a direction of the Commission pursuant to subsection 8 and the use of the Commission by the Commission of any such recording exclusively for the purposes of its functions under this Act shall not constitute
A.
an infringement of the copyright in any work, sound recording or cinematograph film, or
B.
an offence under any of the provisions of the Performers Protection Act 1968.
Subsection 10.
Without prejudice to the generality of subsection 8, the Commission shall have power
A.
to make such contracts, agreements and arrangements and do all such other things as are incidental or conducive to the objects of the Commission.
B.
To acquire and make use of copyrights, patents, licences, privileges and concessions.
C.
To compile, prepare, publish and distribute with or without charge such magazines, books and other printed material and such oral and visual material as may seem to the Commission to be incidental or conducive to its objectives.
D.
Subject to the consent of the Minister, to arrange for the provision of services with or without charge for and on behalf of any Minister of the Government by a sound broadcasting contractor or the television programme service contractor.
E.
To require sound broadcasting contractors and the television programme service contractor to cooperate with the Garda Síochána, local authorities and health boards in the dissemination of relevant information to the public in the event of major emergencies.
Subsection 11.
During the continuance of any emergency declared under Section 10 of the Wireless Telegraphy Act 1926, the Minister may suspend any licence issued under Subsection 3, and while any such suspension continues, the Minister may operate any service which was provided under the suspended licence or require such service to be operated as he directs.
And to continue with the Radio and Television Act 1988, published in Dublin. Part 3, Sound Broadcasting Services and Applications for Sound Broadcasting Contracts. Section 5, subsection 1. In order to secure the orderly development of sound broadcasting services, and having regard to the availability of radio frequencies for sound broadcasting, to allow for the establishment of a diversity of services in an area catering for a wide range of tastes, including those of minority interests, the Commission shall, as soon as may be after it has been established, and may thereafter, from time to time, by notice published in at least one national newspaper, invite expressions of interest in the securing of contracts for sound broadcasting services under this Act. Such expressions of interest shall indicate in general terms the type of service that would be provided, and shall not be regarded as an application for a sound broadcasting contract.
Subsection 2. The Commission shall make a report of its findings under subsection 1 to the Minister, who, having considered the report and after consultation with the Commission, shall specify the area, which area may consist of the whole or any part of the state, in relation to which applications for a sound broadcasting contract are to be invited, and the Commission shall comply with such direction.
Subsection 3. The Minister, having regard to the report furnished by the Commission under subsection 2, and having regard to the availability of radio frequencies for sound broadcasting, may limit the number of areas which he may specify under that subsection.
Subsection 4. The Commission shall, subject to the provisions of this Act, invite applications for a sound broadcasting contract for the provision of a sound broadcasting service in each area specified by the Minister under subsection 2, and, subject to the provisions of this Act, may enter into such contracts.
Subsection 5. Where the Commission invites applications for a sound broadcasting contract for the provision of a sound broadcasting service, it shall, by public notice, specify the area in relation to which the sound broadcasting service is to be provided, pursuant to such contract, and, by such notice, shall invite persons interested in providing such a service to apply for such contract.
Subsection 6. Having regard to the findings of the Commission under subsection 1, the Commission may, in considering applications for the award of a sound broadcasting contract, place greater emphasis on one or more of the criteria specified in section 6(2) of this Act, and whenever it is the Commission's intentions to so do, it shall specify such intention to each person who has indicated his intention of being an applicant for a contract.
Subsection 7. Every notice under subsection 5 shall A. be published in at least one national newspaper, and, where appropriate, in one local newspaper circulating in the area to be served. B. specify the procedure to be followed in order to make an application, and C. specify any other matters which appear to the Commission to be necessary or relevant.
Subsection 6. 1. The Commission shall, in accordance with the provisions of this Act, consider every application for a sound broadcasting contract received by it pursuant to a notice under section 5(5) for the purpose of determining the most suitable applicant, if any, to be awarded a sound broadcasting contract.
Subsection 2. In the consideration of applications received by it and in determining the most suitable applicant to be awarded a sound broadcasting contract, the Commission shall have regard to A. the character of the applicant, or, if the applicant is a body corporate, the character of the body and its directors, manager, secretary or other similar officer, and its members, and the persons entitled to the beneficial ownership of its shares.
B. the adequacy of the expertise and experience and of the financial resources that will be available to each applicant, and the extent to which the application accords with good economic principles.
C. the quality, range and type of the programmes proposed to be provided by each applicant, or, if there is only one applicant, by that applicant.
The quantity, quality, range and type of programmes in the Irish language and the extent of programmes relating to Irish culture proposed to be provided.
And E, the extent to which the applicant will create within the proposed sound broadcasting service new opportunities for Irish talent in music, drama and entertainment.
F, the desirability of having a diversity of services in the area, specified in the notice under section 5.5, catering for a wide range of tastes, including those of minority interests.
G, the desirability of allowing any person or group of persons to have control of, or substantial interests in, an undue number of sound broadcasting services, in respect of which a sound broadcasting contract has been awarded under this Act.
The desirability of allowing any person or group of persons to have control of or substantial interest in an undue amount of the communications media in the area specified in the notice under section 5.5.
And I, the extent to which the service proposed, 1, serves recognisably local communities and is supported by the various interests in the community, or 2, serves communities of interest. And J,
if any other matters which the Commission considers to be necessary to secure the orderly development of sound broadcasting services.
Subsection 3. In considering the suitability of any applicant for the award of a sound broadcasting contract to provide a sound broadcasting service in respect of an area which includes a Gaeltacht area, the Commission shall have particular regard to the preservation as a spoken language of the Irish language.
Section 7. The variation of licence for sound broadcasting transmitters. Subsection 1. The Minister may, if it seems necessary to him to so do, for any of the reasons specified in subsection 2, vary any term or condition of a licence issued pursuant to section 4.3.
Subsection 2. The Minister may vary any term or condition of a licence issued pursuant to subsection 4.3. If it appears to him to be necessary to do so in the interest of good radio frequency management, or B, for the purpose of giving effect to any international agreement to which the state is a party and which has been ratified by the state and which relates to sound broadcasting, or C, if it appears to him to be in the public interest so to do, D, if it appears to him to be necessary for the safety or security of persons or property so to do, or E, on request from the Commission after consultation with any affected sound broadcasting contractor. And finally, F, on request from the Commission on behalf of a sound broadcasting contractor.
Subsection 3A. If the Minister, for any reason specified in paragraph A, B or C of subsection 2, proposes to vary, pursuant to this section, any term or condition of a licence issued pursuant to section 4.3, he shall by notice in writing inform the Commission of his intention and of the reasons therefore, and the Commission shall, within 7 days of receiving that notification, give notice to the sound broadcasting contractor accordingly.
B. The sound broadcasting contractor shall have the right to make representations in writing to the Commission in respect to the Minister's intentions, within 21 days after the service of the notice by the Commission.
C. The Commission shall transmit any such representations to the Minister within a further 7 days, and the Minister, having considered the representations, may make such decision thereon as seems to him to be appropriate.
Subsection 4A. If after having considered the representations, if any, which have been notified to him by the Commission, by or on behalf of a sound broadcasting contractor, the Minister decides to vary any term or condition of a licence, he shall, by notice in writing, inform the Commission of his decision.
B. The Commission shall, within 7 days of receipt of the Minister's decision by notice in writing, inform the sound broadcasting contractor of that decision.
And C, on and from the day following service on the contractor of notice of the Minister's decision, the licence shall have effect subject to the variation thereof by that decision.
Subsection 5. A notice under subsection 3 or 4 may be served on the Commission and by the Commission on a sound broadcasting contractor by leaving it at or sending it by prepaid post to the Commission's address and the sound broadcasting contractor's last known address, respectively, or, if in the latter case, the sound broadcasting contractor is a company, by leaving it at or sending it by prepaid post to the registered office of the company.
Here I go again. Watch me now, cause here I go again. I've been hurt so much.
right now, there's provisions under Section 8 for contracts for temporary or institutional sound broadcasting services. We'll leave the details of that and go to Section 9, the duty of sound broadcasting contractor in relation to programmes. Subsection 1, every sound broadcasting contractor shall ensure that A.
All news broadcast by him is reported and presented in an objective and impartial manner and without any expression of his own views.
B. The broadcast treatment of current affairs, including matters which are either of public controversy or the subject of current public debate, is fair to all interests concerned, and that the broadcast matter is presented in an objective and impartial manner, and without any expression of his own views. Provided that, should it prove impracticable in relation to a single broadcast to apply this paragraph, two or more related broadcasts may be considered as a whole, if the broadcasts are transmitted within a reasonable period of each other.
C. A minimum of 1. Not less than 20% of the broadcasting time, and 2. If the sound broadcasting service is provided for more than 12 hours in any one day, 2 hours of broadcasting time between 0700 hours and 1900 hours is devoted to the broadcasting of news and current affairs programmes, provided a derogation from this provision is not authorised by the Commission under Section 15.
D. Anything which may reasonably be regarded as offending against good taste or decency, or as being likely to promote or incite to crime, or as tending to undermine the authority of the state, is not broadcast by him.
E. In programmes broadcast by him, and in the means employed to make such programmes, the privacy of any individual is not unreasonably encroached upon.
Subsection 2. Nothing in subsection 1 or 1A or 1B shall prevent a sound broadcasting contractor from transmitting party political broadcasts, provided that a sound broadcasting contractor shall not, in the allocation of time for such broadcasts, give an unfair preference to any political party.
3. The Commission shall draw up and may, from time to time, as occasion requires, revise a code governing standards and practice, hereinafter referred to as a code of practice, in relation to any matter specified in subsections 1 and 2.
Subsection 4. Whenever the Commission draws up, pursuant to subsection 3, a code of practice relating to the matter in question, every sound broadcasting contractor shall comply with such code and any revision thereof. So that's part of the Radio and Television Act 1988. We'll look at the provisions for advertisements, complaints by the public, and applications for licences in another programme.
And from a recent feature in The Observer, colour supplement magazine, a piece entitled Daring to be Greater. London has had only 3 licensed radio stations, Capital, LBC and BBC Radio London, in the past 15 years. Against this, New York has around 80 licensed stations and Paris about 50. Another London station, Greater London Radio, is soon to be born. In fact, it is really a case of the King is dead, long live the King. BBC Radio London is no more, closed down with hardly an obituary a few weeks ago. And yet, we rapidly approach year zero, the BBC's Pol Pot approach to broadcasting, which has wiped out the previous 15 years of the corporation's largest local radio station. So keen was Matthew Bannister, managing editor of GLR, to remove any vestiges of past wrongdoing, that for the past 2 weeks his test transmission wavebands have been full of pop music from the 50s to the present. GLR is a totally new station, not a relaunch, explains Bannister, so we needed a gap between the old and the new. It might have been a dangerous tactic, confusing and alienating a loyal audience, except that BBC Radio London had few listeners. The station was attracting only about 150,000 listeners in its last days, making it the least heard in London. Less people were tuned to it than Radio 3 or The Pirates. BBC Radio London suffered from a confused image. Sometimes it appealed to the over-50s, while in the evening it switched to teenagers, but mostly from a lack of knowledge of its existence. It was London's non-station, So much so that last year, the BBC nearly decided not to continue with any station at all in the capital. Only after months of debate did the Board of Governors decide that London must have its own BBC station. So Greater London Radio was conceived, and yet it begins life, recent soon, with a possible death sentence hanging over it. It has exactly 3 years to more than double Radio London's audience, with an annual budget that is 10% smaller at just over £1 million, plus a small amount for advertising. London's two commercial radio stations have much bigger budgets. LBC spends £5.5 million, with £2.5 million going to independent radio news, and Capital just over £3 million. GLR has a brief to provide public service radio and entertainment. We took this route because our research shows that Londoners want a music station, but also one which offers news and views about what is going on in the capital rather than DJ prattle, says Bannister. It has a novel approach with every programme, whether the breakfast show of Nick Abbott, a comparative unknown from Radio Luxembourg, to Tommy Vance in the late afternoon, having an approximate 55-45 split between music and speech. In contrast, Capital offers 90% music with the occasional documentary or feature plus its news, while LBC broadcasts 95% speech. GLR has decided to target its target's audience is between 25 and 45 years old. They are not catered for in London, says Bannister. He is partly correct. Certainly, the two pop stations, Capital and Radio 1, are aimed primarily at listeners aged 16 through 25, although both are now trying to build up an older audience by putting adult pop on their split frequencies. Capital has been playing Capital Gold, a mixture of golden oldies plus albums, at the weekends since the summer, and will turn it into a daily and therefore separate service from the end of November. Disc jockeys such as Tony Blackburn, Kearney Everett, Graham Dean and Mike Dickin will try to woo those over age 25. There is a gap, says Capital's programme controller Richard Park, but it is the same gap towards which GLR is heading. And Radio 1 is also seeking to fill that gap by playing recent albums more regularly in the evenings and at weekends. Park says the older audience like Weekend at Capital Gold, yet the combined audience of the two separate weekend stations is hardly larger than that of Capital's previous single station. The plus, though, is for advertisers, says Capital's managing director Nigel Walmsley. We can target a younger audience on one station and an older one on the other. GLR's lineup of presenters mixes the old and the new. Abbott, who starts the day, is followed by Emma Freud and then Johnny Walker, the former Radio 1 disc jockey. The station has poached two local radio station presenters, Timbo from BBC Radio Essex, who will run an outside broadcast show each afternoon, and Dave Barrett from GWR, the independent local station in Bristol, who will do a chat and phone-in programme from 10 p.m. to midnight. Some of the old Radio London regime survived the massacre. Dave Pearce, Night FM, the modern music enclave introduced last year on Radio London, will have a Monday to Thursday soul-based music show. And Gary Crowley, also from Night FM, will have a Sunday rock show. Other old-timers such as Susie Barnes and Andy Peebles will broadcast at weekends. When the BBC governors agreed that London should continue to have a radio station, they asked that it specifically cater to the inner city and minorities. GLR will have an inner city limit, which will report nightly in the Dave Pearce programme. We wanted to look at a range of issues which concern young people in inner London, says Bannister. It will tend to aim at a black audience. By splitting frequencies on weekend evenings, GLR can cater for other minorities with a jazz programme and a slot for Asians on Saturdays. On Sundays, a gospel show fronted by Paul Jones contrasts with Jewish World. Yet GLR is going to live or die by its mainstream programmes during the day. Radio London got off to a bad start with only 200,000 people a week tuning to its breakfast show, traditionally the best time to woo listeners. Capital's Chris Tarrant, vying with Radio 1's Simon Mayo, gets a weekly audience of 2 million for his breakfast show in London. Nick Abbott's breakfast show will mix music with information, particularly news, traffic and weather, two-minute features and guests. But does the listener want this mix? Tarrant and Mayo essentially play music with some news and traffic, while LBC's AM competes with Radio 4's Today in the speech market.
Today, with an audience of about 1 million in the London area, just has the edge on AM. Neither Capital nor LBC seem worried by GLR. Peter Thornton, LBC's editorial director, says, We will carry on trying to offer the kind of news and information which we have traditionally done, though aimed at a younger and less middle-class audience than Radio 4's. Capital will continue to look more to Radio 1 as its competitor. In fact, Capital and Radio 1 have a near equal share of the 18 to 45-year-old London audience across the week, with Capital slightly in the lead. But frankly, we're not even worried about Radio 1, says Park. Ours is the equality end of the market, and anyway, there are not many listeners who switch from Radio 1 to us, or vice versa. That is true, not only for Capital and Radio 1, but for radio as a whole. Radio listeners, far more than television viewers, tend to remain with a favourite channel. This is due in part to the physical difficulties of switching and the ignorance about frequencies. Audience loyalty will surely be the single largest problem facing GLR. Radio London had a small audience, and probably less than half will switch to GLR. That means attracting and holding on to 250,000 new listeners a week. It's a tall one, and GLR has chosen a daring route. That piece from The Observer, Colour Supplement magazine.
And during its test transmissions, GLR sounded something like this.
Just one day to go.
Thank you.
Radio Fax will finish in December. We have been on the air for 3 months, and through that time you have been sending us over 100 letters each week telling us how much this kind of speech programming is appreciated. We also know that we have a fair number of very enthusiastic blind listeners. So, we remain a legal operation and close down in December unless some government writes us out the licence we have been asking for since 3 years ago. What would the other possible options be? We could stay on the air from the Republic of Ireland, or we could come on the air from England. By making public the time and place, this would be a fairly straightforward act of civil disobedience, and the presumably inevitable court case would form part of the history of broadcasting. If hundreds of you write to say that is what you think we should do, then I suppose we would have to consider it seriously. But we have to make it clear now that these are not options we regard as compatible with a professional operation.
The letters you send are what has made this project worthwhile, and thank you again to everybody who's taken the trouble to write. We get letters from people aged between 17 and 70, and anyone in the media world will know that something appealing to such a wide age range is most unusual. Some of the historical items we have carried, the development of magnetic tape, the story of radar, old BBC transmitting stations, the invention of magnetic recording, from wire recorders to digital tape, and others have brought in letters from people involved in the work up to 50 years ago. If we were staying on the air, one thing we would have liked to do was organise a contact point so that people who worked together years ago could get in touch with each other again.
One thing we might have achieved is the most listened to programme per watt transmitted. And we mean listened to. Many shortwave stations are heard and logged, but your letters make it clear that people do listen to Radio Fax.
The use of shortwaves has fallen significantly over the last 20 years, and everyone seems agreed that, with a view to the future, what Radio Fax has demonstrated is now a useful and appropriate use of 9 kHz of the spectrum. What can you do? Well, if you think Radio Fax or something like it should be offered a licence, you could write to your Member of Parliament at the House of Commons, London SW1A, OAA.
Astronomers get £5 million for powerful new telescope, by Nicholas Schoon in The Independent. A large new radio telescope is to be opened near Cambridge next year, giving British astronomers their clearest view yet of the formation of stars and galaxies across the universe, and their largest step forward for years. Manchester University has been given a £5 million grant by the Science and Engineering Research Council for the 105-foot diameter telescope. In conjunction with 6 other radio telescopes already built, it will enable British astronomers to see 3 times as far, or to see distant objects with 3 times as much detail as now. It will be built at the Mullard Radio Astronomy Observatory of Cambridge University, but will be remotely controlled from the Jodrell Bank Observatory. The new structure links Britain's 2 leading centres of astronomy. It will also extend Britain's Merlin network of 6 radio telescopes, stretching it from the original Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank in Cheshire across the centre of England to Cambridge. This gives it a 130-mile baseline, which, by coordinating the telescopes over periods of several hours, gives the equivalent of 1 telescope 130 miles across. The telescopes pick up radio waves coming in from as far as the outer edge of the universe. Astronomers will use the network to study the gravitational lenses predicted by Einstein half a century ago. These are hidden galaxies which are massive enough to bend light and radio waves coming in from quasars beyond them. Up to 90% of the material in the universe does not emit light and is known as missing matter. The enlarged network will be used to study this. Astronomer Royal Sir Francis Graham Smith of Manchester University said, "This is the major development we have been waiting for, both at Jodrell Bank and in UK astronomy as a whole. We can now tackle new and fundamental questions, such as the origin of stars and galaxies, and the basic cosmological questions of the expanding universe." The telescope will be built by the German company MAN.
And from that to a piece on the commercial radio advertising scene, as featured in The Independent recently. "If British advertising is the best in the world, as most London ad agencies would have us believe, radio commercials must be counted the exception. Indeed, it is an indictment of British agencies that 15 years after the launch of independent radio, the standard of radio advertising is generally held to be so low. With a few outstanding exceptions, most radio commercials are either dull and unnoticed, or they're intrusive and irritating. Part of radio's problem has been that it's been sold to advertisers as a quick and cheap alternative to television, so they have expected to make their commercials quickly and cheaply, and it has sounded like it. In addition, the top agency copywriters have preferred the more glamorous medium of television. The ad business, which may now be getting to grips with radio, which it needs to if the medium is to expand in the 1990s, the government intends to allow 3 new national commercial channels and hundreds of smaller ones. Recently, radio has broken out of the vicious circle that has dogged its progress. National advertisers were reluctant to use it because they had been unable to prove that it worked. The high cost of television airtime, aided by increasing competition among radio salesmen, has led to a sustained boom in radio advertising over the past 2 years. Last year, the station's revenue grew by 26% to £99 million, and this year, the Radio Marketing Bureau is projecting a further increase of 25%. This, in turn, is starting to have an impact on the quality of radio commercials. With large national advertisers such as Heinz, Nestle, British Rail, Guinness and the banks and building societies starting to take the medium seriously and using it for longer-term campaigns, agencies can no longer be as offhand about radio, which in the past led stations to accuse them of protecting their higher-profile, higher-budget television campaigns. Capital, Britain's largest station, is now actively campaigning to improve the quality of radio advertising. It has been running commercials on air aimed at advertising agencies, in which Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones argue that radio advertising is only dull if you are. It also has held 3 seminars for advertisers and agencies at which programme makers John Lloyd and Jeffrey Perkins of Spitting Image fame explained the power of radio and the importance of good editing. All 3 were packed out. More fundamentally, Capital has also tackled the belief amongst advertisers that radio lacks impact. Few questioned radio's ability to communicate powerfully in the Churchill era, it says, introducing a complex research study comparing the impact of ads on Capital with those on ITV and TVAM. The research appears to disprove the commonly held belief that TV's impact is 3 or 4 times that of radio. Indeed, among the under-35s, and ABC One's, it says, Capital has equal impact to the London's ITV stations. What emerged from our seminars is that a lot of television is just a visual radio, says Paul Twivy, a joint managing director of Capital's ad agency, Still Price Court Twivy D'Souza. The problem is that agencies think in visual terms, borrowing ideas from films, instead of using the power of radio and learning from the great radio broadcasts of the past. There are signs that things are changing. Carol Humphrey, managing director of a production company, says a few agencies are now giving her greater challenges, more time and larger budgets. For the launch of an exhibition, she produced a 2-minute history of Royal Britain, complete with Handel's Zadok the Priest and voices of Ian Holm, Janet Suzman, Michael Maloney and Derek Jacobi, checking points of detail with the Bodleian Library and the Archbishop of Canterbury. The result was stunning. For once, a radio commercial was better than the programmes.
Film, Video and Sound 89, to be held at Olympia 2 Complex in London in July 1989, will be the largest technological conference and exhibition ever organised by the BKSTS. The new location at Olympia 2 will provide space for an expanded exhibition, and visitors will see a wide range of production equipment, including lighting, cameras and projectors for film and video, equipment for post-production on film and tape, sound laboratory and cinema equipment. That's July 89, information from 01385 1200.